You're listening to Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell. Thane Maynard's guest this morning is Brian Jorg from the Cincinnati Zoo, here to talk about the zoo's EcoHio sustainability program.
All right, Brian Jorg, it's good to see you here in the studio, not just at the zoo and botanical garden.
Same here. Good morning.
Now, I know a thing that people probably aren't very familiar with is that in addition to the zoo having our great botanical garden, we also are working on native plants and wetlands up in Warren County. Tell a bit about that.
Yeah, the zoo was donated a property of about 700 acres out in Warren County between Mason and Lebanon. And we were wondering for a while, what are we going to exactly do with that? Are we going to grow food for the animals? Are we going to raise cheetahs? You know, with a property that size, there's a lot of opportunity. Well, while researching the property, we discovered that it was historically a wetlands back before it was turned into agriculture. So we kind of kicked around the idea and thought about it, and it just made sense with us being a conservation organization. So we looked into it, and we found out that there's a CRP grant, a Conservation Reserve Program, mm-hmm. which basically pays for almost everything in reconstructing it. And what that is it was created today because agriculture, with the price of corn going sky high, farmers naturally are turning marginal habitat into agricultural land. So this kind of takes it the other way, that if you're willing to take a known historic wetland and take it from agricultural production and put it back into habitat, it would be paid for. So basically, we had the access, we had the funds through the grant, and we had the opportunity. So we decided to create the wetland, and we've been off to the races ever since.
All right. So tell a bit about this, because I myself have been up there lots and jogged around the perimeter of the farm. And now, as you said, you've made those changes. I'm maybe taking out some drainage tile. Obviously, it's a wetland when you see it today.
Yes.
But 3 years ago, I'm not sure I would have said, well, is that the best place or that the place? So how did you determine where it used to be?
We looked at the 100-year flood plan, which had some records from a long time ago. Even walking around the property, I would find species of plants, and without going into the technicalities, we found species out there that typically will only grow in wetlands 99% of the time. And when you see swamp milkweed, when you see mimulus, which is monkey flower, you know that I could sense that, you know, looking at the lay of the land, it helped put the pieces into place. Mm-hmm. So you could tell that there's certain areas out there that in dry years would be farmed, but in wet years, like we had 2 years ago, they couldn't get in there and bush hog it, and the species would return and seed the area. So we're still feeling out the land and feeling properties. There's vernal pools out there which have formed. And like you said, since we've broken up the drainage tiles, there's a lot more water out there than we were all anticipating having at the end of the project.
Well, the last time I went, I really was amazed because I don't go super frequently, so say 4 times a year. Good grief, as we headed into this winter and now heading towards spring, I'll tell you, it bounced back fast. I couldn't believe how many birds I saw.
It's incredible. I was out there. We did a bio blitz in July. We went to establish a baseline, what is currently out there. And if you remember July, it was 102 degrees. It was just blazing hot, dry. We go out there. We had just constructed the dike and the wetland, so basically there's a lot of bare soil. Stopping back later in the fall, just absolutely loaded with waterfowl. There was probably 1,500 geese, mallards, black ducks, pintail, gadwall, green-winged teal, widgeon, you name it, it was out there. And it was really neat to see that if you build it, they will come. It was wonderful to see that return.
Now, I know at the zoo's botanical garden, you've helped lead with lots of native plants, you know, in a display garden to show people here the kinds of things that historically lived in our area and you could have in your garden. But it seems like we've gone wild out at the Boyer Farm.
Yeah, the opportunity out there is incredible. Being a horticulturalist, you typically grow plants that have ornamental values, and I grow a lot of native plants, certainly the trillium and a lot of the native orchids. With this, you're growing plants for specific purposes, and we're kind of reverse engineering. We're looking at everything. If we want quail, what do we need? And we find the plants, the cover, and some of them aren't necessarily ornamental, but they perform a function. It's either provide seed or the cover. So I'm making a list of everything theoretically that we could attract to this property and then just trying to drive the diversity of the amount of species that we can get. Some of it's commercially available. Some of it I'm searching out sources for, and we'll get that, and we can grow it by cuttings or by seed. But I'm looking to get, initially, I think our initial planning, we should have over 200 species of native plants going into this property. So we're going to attract everything from hummingbirds to great horned owls and everything in between. So,
you know, it's an interesting thing because over the years that the zoo has owned it, we've had a farmer work with us and grow some hay that we feed our animals. But we've taken that a step further, too, I know, working with other partners.
Yes, Green Bean is instrumental in this whole project, and they've been assisting us. And we have some future partnerships we're working on currently as well. And what we want to do is the next phase is we're looking at the watershed. And we want to protect the watershed because that feeds our wetland. We're going to put a buffer around there. And then still, they can grow, and they're one of the biggest organic farmers in the area, is to grow our hay for our hoofstock, is to show that we can have habitat as well as agriculture within the same domain. And if managed properly, you can have a win-win situation for both wildlife as well as for agriculture.
You know, it's an interesting process all the way around. Most people, such as me, today live in town or in the suburbs. Like lots of folks, I've had a little garden that I've grown with my kids with a little number of vegetables. But, buddy, you show up where green beans grow on 50 acres, butternut squash, and I'll tell you what, you better get ready for some squash soup because that is a lot of squash. That was just in their first season.
Yeah, it's amazing when you see pumpkins and gourds stacked up and the production you can actually pull off of an area that size. Like you say, I have a little garden that my girls grow, and you know, we'll get a basket of tomatoes or something, but when you pull it out by the truckload, it's an impressive sight to see the harvest come in.
Well, and that's a neat thing. You know, we're growing some food for animals at the zoo, some food for people at the zoo. We're cooperating with a terrific program in Avondale through Gabriel's Place. So it's been a win-win all the way around, and it really does take partnerships. I know you mentioned even through the county parks you've gotten some seeds.
Yeah, Hamilton County Parks has donated some seed for us for the project, and we're always horse trading. We're always, you know, if we have a species we're working with and somebody else needs seed or cuttings, you know, certainly we'll work with them, and it has a synergistic effect. And when you pull in, and this region has some great institutions, great conservation institutions, great parks, arboretums, gardens, you know, you name it. And we're really trying to pull them together and work together because as dollars get tighter, as situations become more critical, we can all work together. And rather than reinventing the wheel or duplicating services, if we work together, we can stretch our resources much farther. And I think in today's world, it certainly behooves us to form those partnerships and work together.
And this concept of restoring wetlands is a fascinating one because often you'll read headlines, whether it's in a newspaper or a magazine or a journal, oh, boo-hoo, this problem's gone, that habitat's gone. And certainly one of the most threatened habitats in the Midwest are wetlands. Because they were easy places to drain and use for agriculture. So this idea of taking, even if it's just 50 or 100 acres, and restoring it really has a big impact. And I've been amazed how quick that impact has really borne fruit, so to speak.
Yeah, as you were saying, Ohio leads the nation. It's lost a larger percentage of wetlands at 90% than any state in the union. And when you look up at the Great Black Swamp and the marshes along Lake Erie that just provided, you know, thousands of acres of waterfowl habitat during migration, it's all agriculture now. It's been drained and gone. So for me, being both a plant and a bird geek from a very early age, having this opportunity to go back in and literally create a wetland, and as you say, when you stand up there and see that place absolutely loaded with waterfowl, and we really haven't even gotten into major restoration yet, it's just exciting to see. Like you say, they're already showing up, and I think as we go, we continue with the plans that we have, it's just going to be, I think, off the charts. So I think local birders going out there and seeing, I think we're going to have a lot of opportunity to view wildlife in that area.
You know, it's a neat role model, thinking of the 21st century, because no one's naive enough to think, gosh, we'll go back to the Garden of Eden and everything be the way it was. But in these areas, these pockets, these restored areas, I think of, for instance, near me, Armletter Park, which is just a couple hundred acres of a floodplain down by the Little Miami. Man alive, you talk about good birding. For many people that visit, it's just a soccer field or a dog park. But man, if you're a birder, bring your scope because you will see some diversity in that one little park. The birds somehow know to find the habitat if it's available.
Yeah, I think wildlife is more resilient than we give it credit for. And as long as we give it half a chance, save the pockets, create the corridors so they can have their migration stopovers. And as long as we're smart about it, I think, you know, it's like you say, it's not a perfect world anymore. And if we do it correctly and smart, I think we can certainly have a great impact on future generations and having something available for the future.
The neat thing, too, is demonstrating to everybody, you know, folks that live out that way, but especially young people that will go out there, whether that's with a bird group, a nature group, a scout group, show that, hey, it is possible to have a positive impact on habitat, not only a negative impact. And it's possible right in your own backyard, and that's a good thing.
We have an Eagle Scout who was interested in doing a project for us. We had somebody donate some red cedar. We gave the red cedar to the Eagle Scout. He's building, you know, a couple hundred bluebird boxes for us. He'll be able to get those up and monitor those with his group. And it's just getting people involved, because we have to get the next generation excited about it. Because if you're not excited about it, if you're not caring about it, it's just going to disappear.
And it's good to have a place people can see positive change. So, Brian, thanks for that good work, and thanks for spending a few moments.
Right, thanks, Thane.
My guest has been Brian Jorg, a native plant biologist with the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Thane Maynard.